the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in north central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
You know, you better believe it. We're right here in the bunker, right here on Thursday, on the 27th of March, 2014. Yeah, Thursday. And it's a sort of a drizzly day today, raining on and off, but it's not too cold, so it's not too bad, not too bad. So I receive a certain amount of mail from prisoners, inmates, and I don't waste a lot of time on inmates that I don't know, but I do. I will put up a stamp or two and send them some information, and then if they send me 5 stamps a month, then I'll keep them supplied in photocopied literature, sometimes even a book. But you know as well as I do that there's a lot of people in there that are never going to get it, and or they wouldn't even be in there. So anyhow, here's a. This fellow's been writing me for a long time from the inside. He's in a prison out in California. Let me read this to you. Racial greetings to you and war. This is blank. Once again, sending my racial respects. Just thought I would put you up on the inside walls of this state prison. I'm the only one on my yard who is straight edge. I'm all alone in this shithole of a gulag. Around me are these flakes and fakes who claim to be skinheads and the Klan with all the wonderful white boy ink and the look of a down-ass white man, yet all they do is chase a dope bag, heroin and speed with a needle to push in their arms. When I ask for anything, such as an extra roll of toilet paper or some cleaner for my cell, I'm considered a needy person and can't get it because they gave it all to the wetbacks and or a coon. Yet, because I don't use drugs, I have to go without. I don't get how I get a food package from the streets of 30 pounds. They become my comrades, wanting a handout. When they receive a package, I'm once again forgotten. Why? Because I'm not a druggie. I'm lost, Tom, all alone in a world of shit in this place. I'm not cool because I refuse to surround myself with white trash. I am in some need of a book, Tom. It has to be soft cover sent to me in a book-type package. Parcel from Metzger Publishing. Do you have anything by David Duke? Well, hell, if I can find one, I'll send it. But I think David Duke's is all hardbound. And I think I can't send anything but paperback in. I just want to read of my people something to take me away from these white niggers I'm surrounded by who claim to be Aryans. This one guy, Tom, has been locked up for 19 years, has a chance to possibly go home, and I told him to get clean and leave the state or the country. Get his head on straight. He wants to get out and do stupid shit and come back the gulag forever. Yet he claims he's working class white power. He's more white powder, not a real skinhead, or he claims Klan. He has a blood drop flag and a KKK tattooed all over him. But I question his knowledge of the Klan, but he is a nigger to all factual knowledge. He's never been to a meeting or a rally. He's got the tattoos and claims he's one. He deals with niggers on a daily basis, buys drugs from them, and you know, Tom, he knows the coons have to put it in their ass to smuggle it in from the visits. He shares syringes with the Mexicans and the coons. Yet he's Klan, skinhead, so-called. This is what I have to deal with here on a daily basis. It turns my insides with their 1488 tattoos, wondering how you could tattoo something you don't like, you don't live by. Anyway, Tom, I'm going to go. Please write me back. Send me a book, please. I think the recidivism rate in prisons is about 50%. Most of them don't learn anything first time around, and then by then they're all hooked on drugs and everything else. But don't ever let anybody try to get close to you just because they've got a tattoo, a racial tattoo. That means nothing. In fact, I've caught informants stenciling tattoos on their arms, the kind they can get rid of with some soap. If anything, we should be discouraging people from ever putting a racial tattoo on their body at all. To many people, it's too late. I mean, during the 80s, they were tattooing up like mad, and they're still doing it. But if you can get to anybody that's thinking about doing it, tell them to forget it. Because if you get arrested, they put those pictures, those tattoos in the police files, and they got you ID'd perfectly. People in prison are notorious liars, too. You don't know who you're dealing with. So even when I deal with people, it's very, very basic, and just basic information like that. But you can never trust who you're dealing with. Because, I mean, a black guy could be riding you, and you... He's white power, you know, because you have no way of knowing unless you have someone absolutely inside the same prison that you can trust to point him out, you know. On the other hand, I won't give up on these guys because some of them are in there and they've got plenty of time to learn and study and read and so forth. And I know a lot of guys like that are doing that. And when they come out, they're going to be able in many cases to get a better job, better career, and keep their nose clean and be very beneficial as a lone wolf. The ones on the outside, the young ones that are around that are so much into meth, I know here in this area meth is running rampant here. You can't ever trust any of those people, and they're not going to listen to you anyhow. You could give them all the material and books in the world, and it wouldn't do any good. But once in a while, you can get one inside the prison who's going to sit down and read and educate himself. And that goes for the female prisoners, too. Sure don't want to write people off like the right wing generally does. All those groups on the right pretty much write off anybody that goes to prison. And even if they've been involved in something racial, they don't back them. They don't write them. They don't send them books. They don't do anything. And so how do they expect ever to recruit more people or get more people involved? How do they? Like I've said many times, the blacks, they do a lot of taking care of their own. They visit people in the prisons. They're not embarrassed. They're not bashful about visiting their sons and their daughters and their husbands and so forth in the prison. White people are, you know, these... A lot of that's from white Christians. They don't even follow their own teachings when it comes to prisoners, where it says that you're supposed to minister to the prisoners. And if you can, if they're worth anything, help them out. I got a nice two-page letter from Matt Hale the other day, too. Matt writes in longhand, and it's pretty hard to read. I'm not going to read it to you other than the fact that he's happy he's been getting books and other information and funds sent to him. And so he's quite happy about all this. I'm going to talk to him about his appeal and all that kind of stuff. I don't think he's got a hope in hell of an appeal going through because we've seen this over and over and over again for 25, 30 years for the order guys and all that kind of stuff. Appeal, 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 you know. Once they got you, they're going to keep you as long as they can. And now they got those FISA courts. It's going to get a lot worse under the FISA courts and so-called homeland security. I watched a movie last night that I thought was very interesting, very well done. It was about the occupation of France during World War II and the underground, which did have a lot of Jews in it, but the information in the film is what's important on their tactics and their ideas and the way they went about sabotaging the occupiers. And I got to tell you, and I've told you before, I don't support anybody that invades and occupies another man's country. I don't do it. I won't do it, whether they're Germans or whether they're English or Americans or Chinese or who else. I will not support anybody that invades and conquers another nation unless there's some reason that this nation has, you know, bombed your nation or something where you're forced to the wall and you have to do something. So that's why I don't make heroes out of occupiers. A lot about how they were tortured, the underground, once they were captured, and how they used snitches and informants and all that kind of stuff, and the weapons they used and the tactics they used. And so if you look at it from that point of view, it's a very good movie. If you're looking at the movie for good or bad guys, that's not the point. The point is it's the underground during World War II in an occupied country. I'm not a good follow orders man. I don't work too well in organizations. I've tried it several times, and usually it doesn't work. I figure that if I had been living in Germany during the time of the rise of the National Socialists, I would have ended up in a concentration camp because I don't let anybody tell me what to think or what to say or anything. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. And that just wouldn't have went over too well with the Gestapo. I think I would have got along pretty well with the Strasser brothers because they weren't, as far as I know, into any oppressive activity. But if I'd have been living... In fact, most of the people I think I know that are really good lone wolves, you think you would have been right at home in National Socialist Germany? I don't think so, because you're too free-willed. You're independent people. You think for yourself. And you might say, well, that's pretty good, but I don't want to do that.
Well, you got to do that. We put you in a concentration camp. Fuck you.
Does that make me more of a libertarian or a, what do you call them, an anarchist? I think sometimes there's a lot of libertarianism in me, and there's a lot of anarchism in me, maybe more than a lot of other things. As long as we keep on the racial thing, I don't think you could trust any government. I don't think free-thinking people can ever trust the government, no matter what government it is. So I know that's going to rub some people wrong, but I've studied in history for so long and gone through so many books and all these different governments and everything. They're just not to be trusted. They get power, and then they start oppressing people. And so I guess philosophically I'm a little more of an anarchist than I am an organization man. I'm not a very good organization man. I've belonged to several political parties and been involved in all kinds of politics, been involved with all kinds of groups and membership groups. They all failed. They all have come up wanting. And so anyhow, that's my position. Not so much that I want government, that I want to straighten out government. It's more that I want government out of my way. I know there are a lot of people out there, oh, well, we could perfect the government. Well, name me one that was perfected. This country could no sooner got going, and they went over to federalism, centralized. And once you go down that route, you're screwed as far as any liberty is concerned. A lot of people fantasize how well they'd get along in a fascist state or Marxist state or some other kind of state. But it never works out that way because there's always somebody wanting to boss you around. I didn't get along in the military. I served 3 years and got out as quick as I could. Because I don't like people telling me when to go to bed and when to get up and when to do this and when to do that and what to believe and what not to believe. I just don't like it. And so I went along to get along in the Army. They tried to court-martial me one time because a staff sergeant who had a little hair up his butt tried to push me around, and I pushed back. But they didn't court-martial me. We had a 2nd Louis, or 1st Lieutenant Company Commander, that understood the situation and understood that Sergeant that was giving me trouble was an asshole, so I escaped a court-martial. But I couldn't stay in the military. No way. I'd have been a raving alcoholic by the time if I'd have tried to put 20 years in the military, I'd have been a total, complete alcoholic and probably a drug addict. Prior to World War II, when the National Socialists were National Socialists and not National Capitalists, I'd have probably been all right working with the Strasser brothers up until the time of the Night of the Long Knives. I just have a feeling at the Night of the Long Knives, I'd have been one of the 1,500 loyal National Socialists that got assassinated. I truly believe it. Or if I'd have stuck with it under National Capitalism, under Hitler, they'd have probably said, boy, you're just screwed up. They'd have shipped me to the Russian front right away. Incidentally, I did track down Dr. Feelgood, the book about the doctor who started out in Germany, started out shooting up these high-ranking officers in the German establishment with meth and other concoctions, along with Dr. Morale over there, who was shooting up Hitler. And then he had to get out of they were sort of suspicious of him and ran him out of Germany. He came over to Brooklyn and set up, and then he started shooting up all kinds of Hollywood stars and then the Kennedys and the whole bit. Well, that book is available. I think you should read it. I think it's about $12-$13. And I'm trying to remember whether it was Amazon or eBay that had it. ABE Books didn't have it. But I think you can get it as low used for about $9 or $10. I'm going to get some sent into the guys in prison, because it's amazing. It's astonishing how the President of the United States was shooting up with all kinds of drugs at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. One false move, we'd have had a total nuclear war, and here we had a hopped up, shot up, shot up President, John F. Kennedy. Anything, Kennedy was high on this stuff when he was shot down there in Dallas, because this doctor traveled around with these guys. Kennedy had him go on the airplane with him to Europe and around like that, so he'd always be there with his little bag of drugs. Well, I see this bisexual moron president we've got spending $9 million just on his airfare, on his planes, traveling over to Brussels to bullshit the boys, and then down to Mideast. I guess he's going down there and kiss Netanyahu's ass. $9 million, and he took over 100 people, I believe it was, or maybe more than that, with him. Then his wife, Michael or Michelle, she's over there in China just on a visit, spending $8,000 a night on a hotel with her mother-in-law. I forget which it was. She's an old bitch. See, we have a monarchy. We transcended. We went from a republic to a sham democracy, and now we're into a monarchy. I guess you'd call it a combination fascist monarchy, because the corporations are wed to the state. And so that's the way it goes. Up here a little bit on why Putin is pissed off. Marcia Gessen, former head of the U.S. government's Radio Liberty office in Moscow, writes in Slate magazine, "Crimea is Putin's revenge. On March the 24th, 1999, the U.S. bombed Kosovo. Putin has been planning his payback ever since. On March 24th, 1999, Russian Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov was on his way to Washington when he got the word that NATO had begun bombing Kosovo. He ordered his plane turned around a few few hours later, he landed in Moscow, that was reeling from the insult of not being consulted. Russians had only a vague idea of what Kosovo was, but a very strong concept of Serbia being a land of fellow Eastern Orthodox Slavs and of Yugoslavia being a rightful part of Moscow's sphere of influence. There was that incident involving Serbia in 1914. Not being consulted or even apparently warned sent a very clear message that the U.S. had decided it now presided over a unipolar world. There was no longer any even a pretense of recognizing Russia's fading superpower status. President Bill Clinton had chosen not to wait the few hours it would have taken for Primakov to land in Washington, allowing him to save face by at least pretending to have been in on the conversation. From this point on, Russian President Boris Yeltsin's administration, already weak and embattled, would be unable to justify its friendly, perennially de-escalating posture towards the West. Anti-American feelings ran so high you could have thought the U.S. was bombing Russia. Kind of like how Americans didn't much appreciate England being bombed in 1940 or Australia being bombed in 1941. The mood I found in Belgrade matched Moscow's perfectly. The country was mobilizing in support of its nationalist leader, Slobodan Milosevic. The few groups of people who continued to oppose him grew more marginalized and embattled by the day. They also grew increasingly paranoid, which paralyzed them. A daily concert in the center of the town was literally drumming up support for the war effort, which had acquired the proud status of a defense effort against the Americans, no less. The bizarre outburst of anti-Americanism, apparently being related to the Americans bombing their country for 78 days, in August, Yeltsin anointed his successor, a virtual unknown named Vladimir Putin. Within a few weeks, Putin became spectacularly popular by launching a new war in Chechnya. Politicians formerly known as liberals praised the Russian army for its performance there. One said it was regaining its dignity. He did not mention Kosovo, but he was referring to the general sense of humiliation that had stayed with the Russians since the spring. In December 1999, Putin became acting president, and the following March he was elected to office. Over the course of the following 14 years, he nurtured in the Russian public a sense of nostalgia for the Soviet Union, and especially for the fear it inspired in the rest of the world. In 2008, Russia invaded the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and effectively annexed part of its territory, and now it has done the same with the Ukraine. This time Putin mentioned Kosovo. Indeed, in his speech to Parliament on Tuesday, he made it very clear that by annexing Crimea, he had avenged Russia for what happened with Kosovo. It was our Western partners who created the precedent. They did it themselves with their own hands, as it were, in a situation that was totally analogous of the Crimean situation. By recognizing Kosovo's secession from Serbia as legitimate, said Putin. This raises three questions. First, if Putin thinks he is paying the West back for Kosovo, why has he waited so long to strike? Second, what could the United States have done differently to avoid setting off this long and frightening chain reaction? And finally, what can the United States do now? In retrospect, the long wait makes perfect sense. Since Putin held power in Russia, he never planned to cede it, so he had all the time in the world. Two of Putin's key character traits are vengefulness and opportunism. I think most world leaders are like that. He relinquishes his grudges and finds motivation in them. He has enjoyed holding the bombing of Yugoslavia against the United States all these years and knowing he would strike back someday. Could the United States and its allies have undertaken anything other than military intervention to resolve the Kosovo crisis? In fact, they did after the bombing campaign, which strengthened support for Milosevic and weakened his opponents. The U.S. poured cash into rebuilding the Serbian opposition. The funding was contingent on the desperate opposition groups agreeing to work together and attending regular coordination meetings held in Budapest, Hungary, and run by people whom participants understood to represent the State Department. You never can trust that State Department. That's pretty interesting. The Wikipedia article on the subject doesn't mention anything about the American involvement in the overthrow of Milosevic. But I presume Ms. Gezin knows of what she speaks. The plan for an anti-Milosevic revolution was worked out in these meetings down to the smallest detail, including where the leaders of each of the 18 participating political organizations would be if mass protests broke out in Belgrade. They did in October 2000, and Milosevic didn't seem to know what hit him. In other words, the U.S. government hit him. Could a plan like that have been carried out without the NATO bombing campaign? Could Milosevic have been removed sooner without the bombing? I think so. On the other hand, would he have succeeded in killing and displacing many more people in Kosovo before being deposed if it hadn't been for the NATO intervention? This is an impossible question to answer. What we do know is that Yugoslavia's wars were very much a one man's war. Granted, I remember back when Milosevic was the new Hitler of the hour and was fighting over the breakup of Yugoslavia, had been predicted in the West long before anyone had heard of Milosevic. For example, in British General John Hackman's 1978 bestseller, The Third World War, World War III starts with a fight in breakaway Yugoslavia, Slovenia, in 1985, that both the Soviets and U.S. Marines intervene in. And it was the removal of the man from power, not the bombing, that finally ended them. Russia's wars are similarly Putin's wars. It is also impossible to know whether Putin would have happened to Russia if it had not been for the bombing of Yugoslavia. I believe he would not have. But now that he has been in power for more than 14 years and is planning to stay forever, what should the United States do? Bombing Moscow does not seem to be an option. Keep in mind, bombing Moscow does not seem to be an option. Airstrikes on Moscow can't be part of America's Plan A. It's just not an option at the present. The nuking of Russia down to melted glass isn't even part of the Plan B yet. However, it should be noted, just for the record, that it still is only the beginning of spring, so the leaves have plenty of time to invade Russia and conquer Moscow before the winter sets in. It's March 22nd, not June the 22nd. But helping the Russian opposition in the same committed, involved, and even meddling manner as the U.S. once helped the Serbian opposition should be. Putin already believes the U.S. State Department is backing the few protest activists left in Moscow and is punishing activists for it. In other words, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, the U.S. State Department is backing the few protest activists left in Moscow. Gezin and Putin seem to be on the same page when it comes to their understanding of how these things work. They're just not on the same side. Look, I don't really know anything about these colored revolutions, but I do have a decent reading of the comprehensive and the former U.S. government official who seems to be omnipresent in the U.S. media is, when read carefully, being fairly blatant. On the other hand, I presume Gezin is not financially disinterested. She's been on the U.S. government payroll before, so it's her bank account's interest to advocate more U.S. tax dollars be spent on a color revolution in Moscow. But the concept of disinterestedness is now considered too boring to remember. Now, let's see, where are we at here? I think I lost my place. There are many differences between Putin today and Milosevic 15 years ago, all of which boil down to the fact that Putin is a lot stronger and harder to remove. All the more reason for the U.S. to put its best minds to work on helping Russians accomplish just this. It may be our only chance of writing the course of history. Whoopee. In other words, pay Marcia Gessen to wage war, World War III. Marcia Gessen is a Russian-American journalist who is the author of Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of the Pussy Riot, and co-editor of Gay Propaganda and Russian Love Stories. And you know, this is why they're pushing this big thing about homosexuals in Russia, because they've got not much else to talk about. Personally, I find the idea of risking a land war in Europe by trying to destabilize Russia unappealing, but that just shows that I'm a wacko extremist, unlike the highly respectable Ms. Gessen. Well, that just shows you behind the scenes how we're trying to slide back into the Cold War, which is absolutely insane, totally insane, completely insane. That's right. Dr. Strangelove is alive and well at the State Department in the USA, and his little brother Putin over there in Russia. That's why no government in the world can be trusted. Not when they have their playthings, these nuclear bombs and biological warfare, biological agents and so forth. Then none of them can be trusted. Well, we've got an anti-Semitic thing going on here, man. The mega big bucks clothing retailer H&M has made a fashion faux pas again. After facing a backlash, the brand has decided to take an item of clothing off the market. This time it's a tank top with an image of a skull in the middle of a Star of David. Yeah. Here's something we should be prepared to go to World War III over. Anti-Jewism rearing its ugly head. A stranger in Brooklyn attacked a 65-year-old Orthodox Jew visiting New York from England Tuesday morning. Then came the news that mega clothing retailer H&M had put this skull in the middle of the Star of David on a new T-shirt. Oh, well, that's the end of the world. That's it. Call out all the troops. Get the atomic bombs ready to go. Well, HarperCollins, the big publishing company, arranged to have a team of evangelical scholars write a counter-argument to Bart Ehrman's latest book, quote, How Jesus Became God, unquote. Both were published this week. And if you're wondering what Ehrman is saying that's rocking the boat, here's the summary. He contends the early Christians had conflicting views on Jesus' divinity, none of which would pass the exacting salvation standard of the Middle Ages. And what's really the truth? He never existed, you idiots. Interesting. A mummy of an Egyptian woman dating back to 700 A.D. has been scanned and stripped to reveal a tattoo on her thigh that displays the name of the biblical archangel Michael. What does that mean? Hell, I don't know. And the Jewish world has been rocked by the news that Ritz Crackers is releasing a kosher-certified bacon-flavored cracker. But kosher bacon-flavored comestibles are nothing new. This story lists several such products on the market. So anyhow, the Jews are pissed off because they're going to have to eat bacon in their crackers, man. Well, I guess a few people down under there in Australia are bucking the system a little bit. The section of Australia's racial discrimination laws at the center of a heated debate over bigotry and the freedom of speech has done nothing to curb racism, a leading law professor says, as Bob Hawke appeals for Labor's original protections to remain untouched. Amid unease among some liberals and Attorney General George Brandis, push the scrap provisions in Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act and the breadth of the exemptions on new racial vilification rules. University of Queensland Garrick Professor of Law James Allen said the changes were already enough of a compromise. So there's a fight brewing down there in Australia and New Zealand about these new laws, anti-discrimination. You can't do that, man. You can't do that. We won't let you do that. That's right. Well, this story didn't get much play. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, famous but incompetent, removed links to the Southern Poverty Law Center from the Civil Rights Division's webpage last week, breaking ties with the groups that inspired a would-be mass shooter with its hate map. The SPLC and the Anti-Defamation League, an outfit dedicated to fighting anti-Semitism, are no longer identified by the FBI's hate crimes page as partners. Upon review, the Civil Rights Program only provides links to resources within the federal government, unquote. An FBI spokesman told the Daily Caller, while we appreciate the tremendous support we receive from a variety of organizations, we have elected not to identify those groups on the civil rights page. There you go. Morris is losing ground fast.
The number of hate groups in Idaho has been cut in half since 2012.
Human rights groups praise it as a step in the right direction, but say we need to do more. Jake Melder is in studio with tonight's big story.
It was this study conducted by the Southern Poverty Law Center that shows the number of known hate groups in Idaho went from 17 to 9 in 2013. Some of those groups include the Aryan Brotherhood and Klansmen. Since 2008, the number of hate groups in America has dramatically risen. According to the study, this increase is a result of the economy tanking and the election of President Obama. In the last half decade, there has been a record number of hate groups, but with the president's re-election and the gun control debate fizzling, hate groups have struggled to find a clear mission.
We see how even the Anti-Discrimination Act or the ordinance has expanded, where we have encompassed more areas. Age, religion, disability, okay, that there are more protections within the workplace.
And it's changing. I say, yeah, it's changing. It's improving. I see many people who communicate very well with us. Even though we don't speak very well English, they still try to communicate with us.
Human rights groups praised actions like the demolition of the Aryan complex as a victory against hatred, but say recent actions from the legislature, such as refusing to give the Add the Words campaign a hearing, leaves Idaho much room to improve. Human rights groups and minority leaders say the key to progress is allowing all sides to have a platform to air their grievances without fear. Despite the decrease, hate groups are still at some of the highest levels in our history. Currently, more than 900 hate groups are active in the U.S. Live in studio, Jake Melder, Fox 9 on your side.
Stupid fools don't realize that the cost of the poker has gone up. More and more people have gone underground. They've gone lone wolf. Oh, there's not near as many of them around. Yeah. Here it says, the SPLC and the Anti-Defamation League, an outfit dedicated to fighting anti-Jewism and fighting Aryan liberty, are no longer identified on the FBI's hate crimes page as partners. Upon review, the Civil Rights Program only provides links to resources. I read you that. But the ADL is furious. Abraham Foxman is furious. The FBI reportedly did not inform the group they planned to cancel their affiliations. We are shocked and surprised and disappointed that this would be done without any consultation with groups such as ours, who have been working closely with the Federal Bureau of Investigation on issues of hate crimes. We look forward to having further conversations with them on this issue, unquote. Abraham H. Foxman, the national director of the ADL, said in a statement, the SPLC has a torrid relationship with the domestic terrorism it claims to condemn. Back in 2012, 28-year-old Floyd Corkins used the SPLC's hate map, which lists groups ranging from the KKK to pro-traditionalist marriage nonprofits as active hate groups, to locate the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., and armed with 100 rounds of ammunition and a 15 Cheekfill A sandwiches, whatever that is, he planned to smother in the faces of his victims. Corkins ended up shooting up the FRC's lobby and wounding a security guard. He was subdued by a wounded security. Well, anyhow, he went on, and so they're not as hot as they used to be. They'll have to work with the SPLC and the ADL secretly. Yeah. We got a report here from Stray Dog from Trenton, New Jersey, New Germany. Hi, TT. Nothing new here in Trenton, New Germany. A white woman who had to ride a bus is beaten and raped by two niggers during daylight hours. The poor woman made a police report, but the pigs didn't help her. Watch the video story from NBC New York.
Exclusive. Did police ignore a rape victim? The I-Team first brought you the victim's story last night on News 4 at 5. She says police and prosecutors waited weeks to investigate her case. News 4 Chief Investigative Reporter Jonathan Dienst is in the newsroom with an I-Team update. Jonathan?
Hi, Gus. New Jersey's State Attorney General today among those voicing concern for the victim and is among those now seeking answers into how parts of this case were handled.
From day one, they seemed like, you know, they could care less, and it was a big joke and a waste of time.
Chris claims police in Trenton waited weeks to act on her gang rape complaint, even though she suffered 5 fractures to her jaw. And officials confirmed sperm and pubic hairs were recovered that night of the attack, December 5th. But that rape kit was not sent out for DNA testing for weeks, and even now, months later, officials say the DNA results that might help identify a suspect are still not back. New Jersey's State Attorney General.
I'm going to take a look at whether any of the DNA results in that specific case can be expedited if they haven't already been received. It's an issue right now that's being reviewed by the Mercer County Prosecutor's Office.
This 30-year-old multiple sclerosis patient says her only mistake was getting lost on a bus in Trenton. When she got off, soon, she says, she was attacked and raped by two men in this abandoned house. She would later face multiple surgeries to repair her face.
Certainly our heart goes out to that woman.
She claims Trenton police took weeks to question her in person, and when they did, she says they mistook her MS condition for signs she was a possible drug seeker.
Was I out there soliciting? Was I out there buying drugs?
Trenton police vigorously deny they mistreated the victim, and Mercer County Prosecutor Joseph Bikini issued a statement saying officials waited weeks to question the victim only because she was still hospitalized. Some experts say with attackers on the loose in Trenton, the Mercer County prosecutor should have made this case a priority, and that DNA results could have been back in days, not months. Chris is angry and upset.
I'm not sure exactly who the district attorney is. They said we would hear from him.
And late today, Chris tells us she got a call from the Mercer County Prosecutor's Office and that a DNA profile of a possible suspect is being expedited and could now be back in a matter of days. Gus?
Jonathan Deans, thanks for the update, Jonathan.
And now you can tell by the reaction to these bureaucrats, they could give a shit less. They don't care. Our heart goes out. That's all their statement. Our prayers and our hearts go out. Well, I'll tell you what. These women better start packing small 25s or 22s. They get someone comes up to rape them, grab them, kill them. Kill them right out. Don't let them get away. Don't let them get away because the law is afraid to prosecute a lot of these Negro niggers. Poor excuse that the DA didn't want to question her because she was in the hospital. That's bullshit. Cops, even on TV, you see that. The cops immediately go to the hospital and try to get information from the victim. No, I'm telling you, you're on your own out there. You're on your own. Well, I see this Holocaust revisionist, Mr. Tobin, down in Australia, has hit the news down there because they're trying to change the hate laws down there, but I think it's going to be not so good. much of the hate law stuff has been come about because of this Holocaust revisionist stuff, not directly because of race, even though they use it for that. And I just had a go-around with this guy, Tobin. He may be thinking, well, maybe he wants to do something right, but he doesn't like the fact that I gave Willis Carto, old-time, long-time right-winger, a lot of trouble, which he knows very little about the things I was talking about Willis Carto. Got all over me on an email. But now he's down there in Australia. I never met the guy, but the way they're doing this hate crimes thing, they're gonna get it around to where we've got the same kind of hate laws here as in Europe. You wait and see. And I say a lot of it's going to be put at the feet of this Holocaust revisionist. I think that was a trap that was set, and no matter how well-meaning the people who got into it were, they fell into that trap instead of just leaving a sleeping dog lie. And at least it goes on and on and on. They keep going on and on and on about it. Well, you're never going to prove that thousands and thousands of Jews didn't die, because they did die. They died not only in those camps, but they died in the East under the Russians, and the pit killings in the East by the Germans. So to go on and on and on and on and on about an argument, you're better off to say, I don't care. You know, that's not illegal. But to keep milking this thing, and of course the Jews keep milking this thing, making all kinds of money over anti-revisionist propaganda. So I used to go along with that quite a bit, but I'm getting sick and tired of it. I think there's too much money being spent that's not going to the struggle for the white race, and it's going more by people who do not believe in white racism, but believe in going over and over and over this, let's clean up the Germans for World War II stuff. No, we got other business right now. You've said all you have to say. How much more are you going to say about how many Jews could fit on a head of a pin, for Christ's sake? I don't know, boy. I'll tell you. Somebody's making a lot of money on it, too. Twicardo and all these other guys in the Institute of Hysterical Review were fighting over all that money from the Gene Farrell estate. Millions of dollars. That's what they were fighting over. Cardo was hiding it in banks in Europe and England and so forth, and his butt buddy Miller took off with a hunk of it down to Australia. Yeah, maybe Tobin's got some of that money. I have no idea. When I saw Willis Carto stand up in court in Vista, California a few years ago with his arm around Mark Lane, who's about as seedy a Jew as you could find, he's my best friend, I said, there's something wrong with this boy. I wanted to carry on the argument, I would be putting Mr. Frederick Tobin's feet to the fire, whether he got any of that money from the fraudulent dispersion of money from the Gene Farrell estate that ended up down in Australia. I bet he did, but I have no proof one way or the other. All I know is Mr. Miller, who was Willis Carto's sidekick, and they were real buddies for a long time. He got out of town with a bag of money from that Gene Farrell Thomas Edison estate, and it's not beyond my suspicion that money, a lot of it down in Australia, got into the hands of Mr. Tobin. No wonder he's such a radical supporter of Willis Carto. However, that may not be true, because there was a hell of a fight erupted between Miller and Willis Carto at the end. So I don't know. It's a strange story, and I don't have time to screw around with it. Well, this is direct from Israel. Remember I told you the other day about all these high school kids that dressed up in KKK costumes or robes, and they had the cross, they had the flag, they had some other kids in dark face, black face with Negro wigs on, and they were having the Negroes bow down before them. Well, the people operate a little differently down there. Parents of students lobbied to tee against condemning their children, whose photographs wearing KKK uniforms have been published by anti-Israel, anti-Jewish websites around the world. Well, let's see here. There's a little more to this. The Mavasaret Zion Municipal Council's Immigrant Absorption Committee voted against condemning an incident last week in which 17 high school students dressed up as members of the KKK, white supremacist organization, on Purim, no less. The students from the Harrell High School in Jerusalem suburb posted to social media pictures of themselves wearing these white robes and hoods. Three of the students painted their faces in black to portray their African-American victims. Well, they're saying parents of the students lobbied the committee against condemning their children, whose photographs wearing KKK uniforms have been published by anti-Israel and anti-Semitic websites around the world. The absorption committee member Jeremy Salton, who was the only member who voted for the condemnation, said he was frustrated and disappointed by the decision. You see how Jews can get away, at least some Jews can get away with about anything. Can you imagine the uproar in this country if a bunch of high school kids dressed up in Klan robes and the whole bit just like this and had blacks with frizzy hairdos and the whole bit bowing down to them? Can you imagine? It would go on for months. Israel says, screw you, Goyim. We'll do whatever we want to. Screw you. Here's a little one-sentence deal I picked out of an article. Let me see here. Where's it at? The first U.S. census that counted black Americans was in 1870, with blacks registering as whites on the census and interracial marriages. Many American family trees do have other groups in them. So, there you go, for your information. Dear Mr. Metzger, just a few moments ago, I was speaking to a Negro woman not far from Detroit, Michigan. I asked her, quote, what were the three countries the USA fought in World War II? Her answer, quote, the Soviet Union and England. The Soviet, the Union, and England. Well, this is sort of funny. This morning, a news editor from Ebony Magazine, no less, decided to show her ignorance and racism to the world in a series of tweets. Jamala Lemieux, the news and lifestyle editor for Ebony Magazine, called Dr. Ben Carson insane for his belief on race, politics, and anything else other than his medical work, unquote. Her objections appear to be that Carson is conservative to some extent, and therefore any idea that he may have on race are forever tainted. Indeed, even his own blackness should be questioned. While Jamala was venting her spleen on Twitter, some conservatives jumped in to defend the black Dr. Carson and push back against Ebony editor. One such conservative was Raffi Williams, black, deputy press secretary of the GOP, and son of Fox News contributor Ron Williams. So I guess we got a little fight there. When Williams engaged Lemieux on Twitter, suggesting she learn more about black Dr. Carson before judging him on politics and race, her immediate response to him was this, quote, oh great, here comes a white dude telling me how to do this black thing, pass, unquote. Moving beyond Lemieux's obvious contempt for the white race, there's one overlooked detail that must be pointed out. Raffi Williams is black. After being informed of Williams' skin pigmentation, Lemieux...
It may be the last thing on your mind while you're shopping, but credit card fraud in the U.S. is up 92% in just 3 years. American Express can alert you instantly if we suspect...
Damn, those black folks sabotaged me. They done sabotaged me. Where in the hell did that come from? Okay, after being, in, well, no, quite frankly, Lemieux could take her apology and cram it. I find it hard to believe that Lemieux's apology was from the heart, considering she is the daughter of a former Black Panther. The inherent racism in Lemieux's comments, the automatic assumption that conservatives equal white, and willingness to tear down successful Black men simply due to his ideology not being in line with the Black groupthink subscribed to by Ebony's news editor, are all the less than shocking. Indeed, this has become the norm. Minorities who don't choose to believe the liberal lie are not equal to the minorities that do. Oh, my. There must be some kind of a internal palace revolt going on here. We got good Negroes and bad Negroes. Liberal Negroes are good, and the conservative Negroes are bad. Well, you know, the Jewish left have always fostered this among the Blacks. As long as they played the liberal game, they were okay. Boy, that Ebony's got some real power, man. They interrupted my show and almost knocked me off my chair here. I won't be able to edit that out either, so I hope you can hit the switch in time and don't blow your ears off. That's about it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day. Ladies' Day in the bunker tomorrow, and 14-5, and I'll talk to you a little later. Yes, I will. Five.